Hello, this is Michael Harlan Turkel, your host of The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Today's sponsor is TechServe. TechServe is New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, serving individual customers, creative professionals, and Fortune 100 companies. TechServe has built solid reputations in its expertise in technology, sales, and service. As a company that believes in honest and forthright business practices, TechServe is proud to sponsor Heritage Radio Network, the promotion of sustainable lifestyles. I'd like to introduce our guest today, Michael Osconis, the executive pastry chef at Le Bernardin, who I met a whole bunch of years ago. I don't know where. I don't know when. That's not important. But have always had a kinship and understanding about the process, not necessarily of plating, but of food in general. Not just the process of how do you make this, but why do you make this and where does it come from? So Michael is here today to kind of talk through the emotions and understandings he has that you don't usually get to see when you're dining at Le Bernardin, which if you have not done, save up. It is quite exquisite, one of the four-star restaurants in New York City. So thank you to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Excellent. First of all, I'd like to say, wonderful website. Is it called like a WorkPad?
There are two, actually.
Yeah.
There's sort of the more literary blog.
Yeah.
That's not too pretentious. That's called Notes from the Kitchen.
Yeah.
And then more of a sort of documentary of the work that we do in the kitchen every day.
And that's the michaelosconis.typepad.com. What's the Notes from the Kitchen?
That one is, you know, I shortened the address. So the original one is michael-lasconis.com.
Yeah.
And then the second one, the workbook, is mlasconis.com.
Yeah. And if you are, you know, a burgeoning pastry chef, read the workbook. I've made the macaroons and they're undeniably amazing.
Thank you.
You know, you can't get like anything like that. You have to fly to Paris.
Well, it was important for me to create something that might be of use to other pastry chefs and actually put something up of content.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot out there there's a lot of static on the internet.
Yeah. Did I also mention he's one of the most giving and sharing pastry chefs out there? There's a great community within the kitchen, and you have a couple friends who we'll talk about and conversations you've had with them, but ask him a question. He'll respond. Wanted to kind of jump into the idea, the analogy of cooking and architecture and applied arts and crafts and even photography to pastry. I had stopped in Le Bernardin once, actually photographed a day with Michael in his kitchen, which I think can be found on the Notes in the Kitchen.
Yeah, I stole a few of your images.
Completely fine. like I said, sharing. And showed me this amazing book, and it was simply just portraits. It's Portraits of the Chefs by Hervé Amiard. If you know these names, Pierre Garnier, Pierre Hermé, I think Alain Ducasse was in there too.
All the big French guys.
It was awesome. I mean, I was in awe, you know, absolutely awesome, thunderstruck, killer, simply portraits.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, showing them black and white, standing there with very few elements of the kitchen. I think like Pierre Hermé had a toque on, kind of made him look like the Michelin man.
But they all told a story though.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of reminiscent of, I don't know who the photographer was, but there was a great series back, I think, at the turn of the century. And it might have been a French photographer who was photographing just regular laborers.
Yeah.
And sort of in their garb or whatever. But
oh, the German Occupations by August Stanler.
There you go. Yeah. And, you know, so they were kind of taken out of their context, just put in front of a blank wall. But you kind of got the essence of what they were about just by their uniform or the tools they were holding.
Yeah. But I mean, it was completely awe-inspiring just to see these people dressed down, because the one thing that happens more so with pastry, I think, than with executive chefs, hotline, is that they're stuck way, way, way back in the kitchen or
sometimes
downstairs.
Like that.
Yeah, downstairs in the basement. Yeah, believe me, there isn't necessarily a rift between BOH and FOH. They like staying away from the people. That's why they chose that profession. But Michael gets out there, and I don't mean in the restaurant, but gets out there in the art world and gets inspired by architecture, by, you know, galleries. Most recently, talking about Alexander Calder, an exhibition. Where was it? At the Whitney?
I believe that was at the Whitney, and it feels like it was just a few months ago.
Yeah.
It was probably 2 years ago now. And that was that was kind of awe-inspiring on many levels. The first thing that struck me, wasn't even a full retrospective. It was just a showing of about 5 years worth of work, and the prolificness of that guy was astounding.
Yeah.
And you saw a progression from, you know, one experiment to the next, and you saw a progression of ideas and maturity and technical prowess that I think as chefs we kind of mirror that urge to continue to hone our craft.
Yeah, I think a funny analogy would be a lot of people think Alexander Kahler just makes, you know, twisted metal and right. mobiles, and a lot of pastry chefs just throw on a canela sorbet or ice cream afterwards, but there is a true craft to being able to develop a vision or the best, and you know that's where he comes into play.
Exactly. And I remember, you know, strolling through that exhibit. I don't really do the sugar and chocolate showpiece thing too much, but I was struck by how much some of his sculptures, both the kinetic and the stationary, kind of mirrored a lot of the work being done by pastry chefs and all the big competitions, the Coupe du Monde and whatnot. But one thing that you actually mentioned in a conversation that we had, one of the things I try to do with my plating style, well, I take inspiration from all these sources and sometimes from architecture and sometimes from painting. They're never directly expressed on the plate. It's all kind of jumbled up in the mind, and then it gets pushed through a filter and somehow it's in there. But one thing that I do gravitate towards is mixing of hard edges. You know, we have molds that are perfect spheres and perfect rectangles, kind of combining those hard edges with softer, more organic, indeterminate shapes.
Yeah.
And I think if I were to pin down a presentation style, that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah.
And that was something you see a lot with Kahler.
Yeah, yeah. And with Kahler, who was very much influenced by Piet Mondrian, there was a felicitous meeting between the two, which kind of was that amalgamation. So talk about pinpointing, you know, understanding an art movement to be inspired by. That's an excellent one.
And another thing too, that I mean, a lot of his work is bound in the realm of physics.
I mean,
he's dealing with gravity. He's dealing with, you know, external forces manipulating the work, and that's actually one of the biggest challenges of a pastry chef.
Yeah,
you know, we're trying to maintain a certain texture at a certain temperature, trying to stand things up on end to a certain degree. So I can definitely appreciate.
Yeah.
You know. My biggest challenge sometimes is gravity.
Yeah. I think a lot of people can say that. And even outside of the pastry world, I mean, damn gravity. But Michael was also saying that the standardization of molds and shapes sometimes are limiting in the pastry kitchen.
Sure, sure. And God knows that these companies are coming out with ever more variety of things.
Now, what are the big names? Like Ateco?
Yeah, I mean, they're actually more probably in the realm of... cake decorating and stuff,
yeah.
But there's a lot of European companies. Demarle is one. They kind of basically made all the silicone flexible molds, and that's something I've talked to Alex Stupak over at WD50 about, and he's kind of been outspoken and being sort of anti mold, and so he's basically doing a lot of things himself with, you know, cut pieces of plastic and masking tape.
Yeah.
And, you know, people think of the kitchen at WD-50 as being high tech. And, you know, I think I heard Alex once say that, you know, it's really more about arts and crafts.
But you can eat the glue.
There you go.
Yeah. What's also kind of interesting is that a lot of the vocabulary being used to talk about these techniques is kind of more and more derivative of talking about art. I mean,
sure.
There was a standardization about, you know, chocolate and how to describe it and explain the process. But what are new pieces of vocabulary or, you know, phrases?
I can definitely tell you some things that interest me on a personal level. A lot of these things are things I don't even know that can be expressed, but I think it's worth going through the motions and asking the questions. You know, taking any kind of other art form, writing, you know, how do you create a rhyming couplet in food? Is that possible?
Yeah.
You know, what is the culinary equivalent of the ellipse?
Yeah.
You know, the dot, dot, dot.
Three little dabs of something on a plate.
Sure. Yeah. You know, what is culinary alliteration?
Yeah.
You know, is it beets, barley, blueberry, and I don't know. And I think those are kind of fun ideas to play with. Music. I love thinking about music in terms of food, and I often do this with another pastry chef friend of mine, Brooks Headley over at Del Posto, who's actually a pretty accomplished musician. You know, we've talked about, you know, well, if you listen to old Sonic Youth, you know, the feedback was in perfect harmony, and you listen to that stuff and it's like it wouldn't sound the same without that feedback or that dissonance. You know, how do you create that dissonance in food? Or Thelonious Monk, who famously would play the wrong note.
Yeah.
But it sounded amazing.
Yeah.
You know, what, you know, do we do that with bitter counterpoints in a dish or with very acidic counterpoints? But, you know, at the end of the day, it still has to sound beautiful. It has to look beautiful. It has to taste good.
Delicious dissonance.
Yeah.
Another point that you brought up actually about food that was interesting is the idea of playing live versus recording in the studio. So rather than just, you know, going and buying a prepackaged Twinkie, you know, having to create the same Twinkie every day.
Sure. And it will affect how you construct the dish.
Yeah.
Just like it, you know, a song that's written just to be recorded in the studio, you know, well, that might be the dish that I do for a photo shoot for Art Culinaire. You know, if you look at that magazine, so much of it isn't really based in reproducible reality.
Yeah.
So
nor do I eat from that perspective. I mean, sure. I don't sit underneath the table looking up at almost a negative 10 degree angle.
But I mean, I love the magazine. I mean, it's of course.
Fantastic
but,
magazine.
You know, so there's a real world and you know, and even from venue to venue, it's a different context. If I were working in a 20 seat restaurant, you know, where we did 50 covers a night, the food might be different than at La Bernardin where we're doing a couple hundred.
Yeah. And especially in what kind of setting it is.
Yeah.
Four star, multi-course, Meunier-Dies, you know, there's a lot more than just, you know, a quenelle of ice cream on top of a molten chocolate cake.
Sure.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but, you had also discussed the idea of highbrow versus lowbrow, which I find hilarious. Who was Robert Williams?
The kind of trend that's been happening in dining the past, I don't know, I think it started in France a decade ago, sort of the casual.
What doesn't?
The casually refined bistro. You know, it was where all the cooks from the four-star places or three-star places, you know, they just wanted to open up a simple bistro. They were using inexpensive cuts of meat and what have you, but they were doing amazing food with no tablecloths, no pretension. Is that making highbrow lowbrow or the other way around? You know, is a place like Momofuku, is that like Robert Williams being shown in a fine art gallery?
Yeah.
Or, trying to think of, you know, other analogies, you know, the ubiquitous Ed Hardy t-shirt now.
Yeah.
You know, that was lowbrow that went highbrow and now it's back to lowbrow.
Yeah.
It's interesting. And I think food kind of has those same trajectories.
Yeah. And speaking of those influences, as you've said, you know, Calder has influenced your plating and your design. Do lowbrow things like Ed Hardy ever influence?
Sure. I mean, actually, I almost think that, I mean, what's the common subtext in a lot of I don't know what's the right word for it, lowbrow art
or industrial art.
Sure. I mean there's always an ironic subtext running through a lot of that, and I think there has been a lot of irony in food as of late, especially kind of pulling on those nostalgic heartstrings. You know, that's when you start to see pop rocks and desserts you know, I'm guilty of it too. I have a dessert right now where we take Rice Krispies and we manipulate them a little bit, but they're still Rice Krispies.
Yeah.
Or, you know, look at most of the menu at WD-50, like you were saying, that it's all kind of rooted in nostalgia. It's all familiar things that have just been manipulated.
So it's all about kind of understanding and cooking for your demographic. And we're going to use this as a quick break. We'll be right back with Michael Oskolnis, a pastry chef at La Bernardin, and a special call-in guest, hopefully. We'll see. Awesome. But we'll be back in a sec. This is Michael Harlan Turkel, and you've been listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. Welcome back. This is Michael Harlan Turkel, and you're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. We have a call-in guest, Francis Lamb of salon.com/food. Hello, Francis.
You're very gracious to give the full link. That's very...
Well, I didn't do www because I thought that was understood.
Because it's HTTP.
Yeah.
But anyway, excellent. Hi, great to talk with you.
Excellent. Francis is a wonderful writer, used to write for Gourmet. One of my favorite pieces about calling yourself a cook rather than a chef, actually, which we might talk about. But is also a good friend of Michael Osconis, and they've delved into a lot of discussions on similar topics that we've hit thus far, but we're going to kind of talk about the chef's artistic intent. We were just recently talking about the difference between highbrow and lowbrow food and inspiration, but also cooking for a demographic. And I know you and Michael have talked about, you know, what's a chef's role, how important is the enjoyment of the end product, and how well is the message conveyed. Have you ever dined at Le Bernardin?
I have.
Excellent.
Thankfully.
Yeah. And did you get it? Did you understand Michael's desserts?
Yeah, I did. And I said, you know, maybe it's a little bit funny to be talking about them with him on the line. But,
that's all right.
You know, it was, but it was very clear that they were very much about pleasure.
Yeah.
You know, it was very clear that they were about enjoyment. And I mean, one of the things I love, one of the reasons why I love the conversation I've had with him is because that comes through very much in his cuisine. It comes through, yeah, and he articulates that really beautifully. Meanwhile, you know, and I think that as a role, his role as a pastry chef, I think also influences that. I think that he, you know, he's talked about the idea that pastry is going to be about making people happy. It has a sort of different function in the meal, has a different function in experience than what the savory kitchen is going to do.
Yeah. I mean, we were also talking about the idea of, you know, new vocabulary about food writing, maybe using art, but do you get to talk about emotions? And this seemingly is what you're saying, that he created a completely different mood and emotion than the rest of the meal. But how do you, you know, evoke such things as, what was Michael saying to me before? Melancholy. And
sure. Well, I mean, you know, and I think that's, you know, kind of what we were initially geeking out about,
yeah.
You know, was, you know, the artistic intent and how do we relay that to the diner? When, I mean, you have to be honest with yourself as a chef that not everybody cares to know the story. It's
right.
True. And I think the question that Francis threw back at me was, well, how do we get people to care?
Yeah.
About if that presentation was inspired by Calder, or if you were trying to hit that wrong note, like Thelonious Monk, or whatever the emotion you're trying to evoke is.
Yeah, and Francis, have you figured out a solution? How do we get people to care?
Well, I mean, I have. I'm going to start a consulting firm very soon.
Yeah.
So keep it away on the air.
Yeah,
but I mean, I think the one thing that's really interesting and you know, something that I used to teach writing, and a lot of my students, and literature, and a lot of my students, you know, one thing I would really often caution people against is, you know, trying to get too much into ethereal intent, you know, trying too much to read into, you know, snippets of the writer's biography that you know, and trying to sort of like divine why are they saying this and why are they trying to say this way, and have that cloud too much your experience of the work itself. And I think that in cuisine, you know, it's kind of the opposite problem, which is that no one wants to do that. No one tries to do that. I mean, it's not true that no one does, but I think that, you know, there is something so primal, obviously, about eating that I think the natural thing, or maybe the instinctive way to engage with food is to eat it and then analyze, taste good, bad, and then everything else stems from that. You know, I think we're so hard. And I think, you know, there's the idea that the taste good bad thing too. I mean, there are certainly we've developed, but you know, there were really instinctive reasons for why certain flavors or certain tastes are hardwired for us to like, and certain ones, you know, were hardwired to not like. You know, so many toxins in so many toxins have a bitter flavor. And so I think so at some point, like, we've just learned to avoid things that tend to be bitter.
Except at the same time, I was one of those kids that put my tongue on a battery. No, because I actually liked that sensation and flavor.
Well, you know, you've evolved beyond, you know, our purpose of our machinery.
Trying to become machinery.
Like that. So I think that a lot of people have a really hard time. So one of the things that really Michael inspired me to think about was how is it then that, you know, what does it mean for a chef as an artist if there's a whole range of reactions and emotions you have to kind of actively avoid people feeling? I think with visual arts, with other so many other arts, you know, you can push people, you can challenge people and throw things in their face that are ugly, or that we would, you know, typically think of as ugly or are harsh, or, you know, you can do that stuff and not everyone's going to respond to it in a way that, you know, you like, but a lot of people would be willing to go there with you.
Yeah. So you're kind of saying how much of the eating experience is aesthetic versus, you know, it's not olfactory. It's a, you know, umami, it's flavor.
How much of it is just like, you know, you again, like this sort of like really instinctive, like I need food kind of reaction to it. And, you know, if you decide as a chef/artist tomorrow, I'm going to really push the boundaries of, like you said, melancholy, or push the boundaries of how a diner is going to feel sad or nervous or scared or horrified. No one's coming back to your restaurant.
Like, well, but there are cases where you know, there are a handful of chefs out there who, you know, a visit to their restaurant is akin to going to a performance art piece.
Alinea, Michael had mentioned.
You know, Alinea is a great example, and of course, you know, that was, I think it's safe to say that's highly influenced by El Bulli and Farina Adria. You know, there are so many aspects of the meal at Alinea that that kind of play into that performance, and there's a lot of diner interaction, and it's almost like Grant is creating a dialogue between the chef and the diner. And then, you know, there's the famous, I think it was maybe a season or two ago, where come dessert, the table, if it wasn't already covered in some sort of latex covering, a latex mat was basically stretched over the table, and your table became the plate. Someone would come tableside and basically plate the dessert directly on the table.
Yeah.
So it was very primal. But I think only a few people can get away with that.
Yeah. Well, that also extends the dialogue between the chef and the diner, because now you have someone to ask questions of and see the process, mm-hmm. and it makes it not just intimate, but exposed. Is that something that you ever mm-hmm. want to approach?
Sure. I mean, like I said, it's something I think about all the time. I think about how to use these devices from other art forms or crafts, and how do we use that in cooking? And is it useful? And is the end result delicious?
Michael was also mentioning a conversation that you had with him, Francis, about the idea of politicizing food, maybe in a similar way of artistic propaganda. So, I mean, past emotion, can you carry a message with a dessert?
I mean, do we already do that with, are we now forced to do that with our choice of ingredients?
Yeah.
And so, will we in the future be forced to do that again with energy sources? You know, I don't know that we can do a culinary version of Guernica, you know, or something like that. But, you know,
black and white chocolate.
Right? Why not?
Yeah.
Why not think about it?
Yeah. So, Francis, anything else you'd like to interject? Because I know that you and Michael have had a lot of these heady, as you said, geeked out conversations about food in general.
Not as many as I'd like, really. I don't tire of it. I mean, that's a really good question. It's funny because and maybe this is not actually a particularly useful thing to say, but when we talk about politicizing our food and we talk about how do you project a message on the plate, you know, certainly like you just mentioned, sourcing is a really big issue, and like there are a lot of reasons why you would source an ingredient from a particular place. Some of them are political, and some aren't. You know, and all of a sudden, but you know, I work at Salon, which is primarily a news and culture site, and you know, the TV is on behind me, and people from the right and left are screaming at each other all day long. And I think about that, too. I think about, I think about politics in those terms a lot, and primarily in those terms, even. And what does it mean to be serving food that would be politically acceptable to one group of people and another, versus another? You know, like, it's so funny that arugula somewhere along the line became this sort of, you know, it became this sort of like shorthand for, oh, you're this effete, you know, liberal elitist from the coast, and you're not a real American.
I had arugula today. So
yeah,
I don't know what
that's a combination of the two things.
But yeah, I think that also extends to, you know, how we actually choose to manipulate or not manipulate our food. I mean, I think there's kind of been a certain rift in the shoppers who tend to pick the best ingredients and do nothing to them. And on the other end of the spectrum, you have the manipulators who are pureeing and dipping it in liquid nitrogen. And actually, there are some great people. And actually, Francis and I sat together at a dinner from Sean Brock from McCready's in Charleston just a few weeks ago. And I think he's one of those great exceptions where he's mastering both ends of the spectrum. He's growing his own food, and he's also putting sort of a very contemporary spin on it. But I think there is a politicized aspect to, you know, I famously had at Chez Panisse, I've had as dessert a bowl of dates and tangerines. And is that shocking, or is the opposite where you have 13 ingredients on a plate that have, you know, gone through all kinds of manipulation? Is that shocking? I think it's all about context and your point of view.
I mean, but you've never put arugula, like a croquant in dessert, and someone's marched back in the kitchen and said, "Excuse me, sir, but I am not a liberal."
You know, when you put bacon ice cream on the menu, though, you see those two camps come out. You see people who are like bemused and befuddled, and the people who want a pint to take home.
Yeah,
you know, especially in a fine dining. You know, that's why I said, you know, it's funny to see irony enter the fine dining scene, because, you know, you can be served Pop Rocks in a 4-star restaurant.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, that's the whole theater of it. You know, Michael was mentioning how it's kind of a choreographed script, and you know, there's a character arc to the meal. There are, you know, how many acts? 5 acts to a Shakespearean play. So there are. How many to a tasting menu? 12, 15, 20. Might as well pair them with emotions and different sensory elements other than the same, you know, rote idea of lifting utensil down to plate, into mouth, chew, masticate.
But and it's cool because there are interesting ways you can marry that tasting menu format with that physiological, sensorial thing that we have as humans. I remember before Lenny opened, when Grant Eckerts was still at Trio, and we started talking about, you know, those long format tasting menus, and, you know, where do you intersperse bits of sweet? And, you know, because the pastry chef always gets screwed in that situation. And he's like, well, doesn't it make sense to have, and he kind of coined this term rolling hills, where you kind of have 3 or 4 little mini progressions and peaks and valleys over the course of 20 course meal, rather than a build up, a really big rich protein and red wine, and then a drop off to a couple of, you know, probably ignored dessert courses.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I mean, you know, there is a lot of room to play with ideas.
Excellent. Well, I just wanted to thank you both, as we unfortunately have run out of time, but definitely have enough fodder for another show. Thank you, Francis, so much for calling in. Next time we're gonna have to get you in the studio. Michael Lasconis, pastry chef Le Bernardin. Stop by, see him, see a, you know, theater on a plate, and maybe taste pleasure, taste emotion. Stop back Tuesday, 3 p.m. Listen to The Food Scene, Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Just want to thank our producer, Jack Inslee, engineer, Dan Brindell, and again, TechServe. Shout out to you. Remember, next Tuesday at 3. Hope to see you there.